This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Stay tuned next for Positively Revolting Talk Radio. This morning, Ani and Lynn will welcome in studio Pulitzer Prize reading journalist David K. Johnston, who is in Portland to speak on the rise of the monopolists, why the few get rich while your paycheck shrinks, and take your calls coming up next, right after these announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland appearance of David K. Johnston, author of the book, The Rise of Monopolists, Why the Few Get Rich While Your Paycheck Shrinks. The book explains how the already very rich have for three decades quietly earned huge profits with help from politicians. David K. Johnston will be speaking at the First Unitarian Church on Friday, June 14th at 7 p.m. about the devastating economic stories unfolding in the public record that major media do not cover. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thought will tell the world how you cast your vote. And good morning, good morning. It is about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are tuned to your very own community radio station. That is KBOO. You're listening to Positively Revolting, and I'm your host, Ani, and I'm here with Lynn.
Yes, you are.
Good morning, one and all. This morning, we're very excited
because we're also here
to be joined by David K. Johnston. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and expert on taxes, accounting, economic, public finance, and business. He's a distinguished visiting lecturer who teaches the tax, property, and regulatory law of the ancient world at Syracuse University and Whitman School of Management. He's also the author of several books, including the most recent, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, as well as Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. His recent article is entitled The Other IRS Scandal. It appears in the Columbia Journalism Review website. David is speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church, that's at Southwest 12th and Salmon in Elliott Chapel. He'll be speaking on the rise of the monopolists, why the few get rich while your paycheck shrinks. Good morning, David. Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thank you, Ani, for having me.
It's a wonderful thing. We are honored to be with you in studio this morning. And let's just sort of jump straight into things. It's a huge topic to cover in about, 50 minutes. Let's see where we can go. Let's start with sort of the meta. There are those that look around at our current economic system, at the fact that Portland has over 2,000 people sleeping on the streets or homeless every night, the fact that, finding a job, even with a college degree, I know in Portland, again, I'll just keep going with the local scene, I have a restaurant that we often go to after the show. And the waiter who works with us, weekly, was talking about how he had just gotten his degree. He was very excited about this. And my partner says, what do you want to do now? He says, I want to keep this job.
Yes, that's not surprising, Ani. That's happening by design.
Mm-hmm.
One of the important things Americans need to understand about the economy, and which my peers in the mainstream media have done an awful job of. I mean, I spent 40 years working for the biggest and best papers in the country, including the LA Times, and the last 13 years of my career at the New York Times, is that the Reagan Revolution is doing exactly what it promised to do in 1980. And what it promised to do was to remove the shackles of regulation and that we would see an enormous flowering of investment in jobs. Well, we are seeing a flowering investment in jobs. The investments are being made in China and Vietnam and India. The jobs are in China and Vietnam and India. And when I'm in a fey mood, I sometimes observe that the most generous people in the history of the world are the American workers who voluntarily – who in fact did not just voluntarily – who voted to give up their middle-class lives so that the rural poor of Asia could have a chance at a decent life. And that is exactly what's going on here. And let me give you just a killer little fact. Everything I do is from the official government data and court records and whatnot. And people can disagree with my interpretations, but all the numbers I give you come out of the official data. In 2011, the average income of the bottom 90% of us, that's over 270 million Americans, their average income per taxpayer fell back to the level of 1966.
Hey, that's the
year I was born. 1966. Well, that's... And you've got gray hair, not as much as me, but gray hair.
That's true.
And Lyndon Johnson was president back then.
Mm-hmm.
The income is up $59 from then, not that you'd notice less than $5 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you plot that as one inch, how did the people at the top do? Well, the top 10% starts at about $100,000 of income. Their line compared to one inch would be 163 feet. The top 1% would be over 800 feet. And the top 1% of the top 1%, which is really the group we should be concerned about, that's the plutocrat class. Mitt Romney, by the way, is at the very bottom of that pile just about.
Poor little fella.
Their income went up almost 5 miles. 1 inch to 5 miles. From now, 2009, the Great Recession ended. From 2009 to 2011... 121% of the increased income in America went to the top 1%. How is that possible? How can they get more than all the increase? because the bottom 99%'s incomes went down. Mm-hmm. And of that increase, over 300 million people in America, 15,600 households got 40 cents out of every dollar of increased income in the entire country. It is the policy of the government of the United States of America under the currently elected Congress and president to take from the many and redistribute to the very wealthiest among us. And this was very powerfully brought home to me last night in Salem, where I spoke at the Grand Theater. They showed a documentary called American Winter. It's about eight families in Portland, very brave, courageous, loving families who lost their jobs. And they were found by calling 211, which Oregon now has statewide. And it was painful to watch. And yet the dignity of these people, the love they had for one another, they're sticking together in awful circumstances. Are really powerfully portrayed in American Winter, and I hope everybody who's listening to this show sees this documentary.
And tells their friends about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds really powerful. So instead of looking around at the system, and like so many will look at it and say, well, the economic system's obviously broken. It's not working.
If you talk to the leaders in Congress, it's going just fine.
Right. Then there's the other side of that that says it's working just fine for those that
design
it.
Except for the evil Obama, who, of course, as the Republicans all know, really isn't legitimately president.
Right. So in fact, you would definitely be on the side of, no, the system is working exactly as it's designed to work.
Yes. And part of the reason my talk tonight is called Rise of the Monopolists is that what we're doing in America is removing competitive markets. We are passing laws, and I'm going to tell you about one that's gotten, to my knowledge, not one word of coverage in the state of Oregon, an Oregon law. We are removing laws that make companies engage in competition, the rigors of the market. We are taking away consumer rights. We have a whole series of laws that force you to pay taxes that never go to government but are kept by the people who collect the taxes, the businesses. Oregon is one of 20 states that have a law that allows employers to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. No law in any of the 20 states that have this requires telling the workers. The money's withheld from your paycheck. You paid your taxes. The company then gets a credit from the state in most states equal to the withheld taxes that they pocket. In Oregon, a law passed in 2011 called SB 219 has a $4 million cap. But trust me, the experience in all the states is that as time goes by, those caps disappear and they
Yeah, I always
vanish.
Wondered about those caps. And, yeah. Unless it's for some people, rich people having to pay Social Security. That's a different
if
story.
If nobody noticed the cap on this particular thing, trust me, nobody's going to notice when the cap goes up. And it is probably targeted at a specific company that's not in the legislation. But what they get is a $4 million loan that will be repaid by the income taxes, the Oregon state income taxes, withheld from the workers' paychecks. Now, across America, 2,700 companies have these deals to tax their employees. The total amount of money is in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year that we can identify because some states treat all this as proprietary and confidential. But I got General Electric to acknowledge that in Ohio, it is getting $115 million that's being withheld from its workers' paychecks to refurbish a jet engine factory on which they're spending $126 million. So think about that. The taxpayers are putting up 92 cents on the dollar. Now, if that factory earns an annual 8% profit on the investment, it earns an annual 100% profit for GE. And the schools and the parks and the Natural Resource Department and the rest of the state government doesn't get that money, which means people either have less government services or higher taxes, or the government borrows more money. Yeah.
Sorry, I was
One of the things going on in America is that very big multinational corporations have figured out how to profit off their taxes. Now, some people listening may remember that 11 years ago I broke the story that Enron did not pay taxes, mm-hmm. and that the taxes embedded in your bill to Portland General Electric, never would get to the government, almost $1 billion. And the legislature passed a bill, SB 408. My story started it. Ken Lewis and some other people in town, you know, got on this case. And it said you either have to turn the taxes over to the government or you got to give them back. Well, for Portland General Electric, a freestanding company, and Northwest Natural Gas, this worked just fine. You can go to the state reports, and it was real easy to figure out. The problem was America's leading monopolist, Warren Buffett. His company is PacifiCorp, and they were like Enron, upstreaming the taxes. And so they kept saying, well, we don't know how much we pay. And, of course, the answer was all the bill had to say is you will calculate your taxes as if you were a freestanding company. And after years of lobbying, they got that law repealed. So if you're a PacifiCorp customer, the taxes embedded in your electric bill, at least the state-level taxes, will never get to the state of Oregon. It's about 1% of your bill.
Austerity?
Austerity.
Austerity?
Oh, you mean helping the rich drive down asset prices and wages so they can get richer? You know, there's an important element to understand.
I just don't remember austerity being that sort of definition. I thought it was, you know, watching your P's and Q's with money a little bit. It's that whole mindset, the whole changing definitions of what words mean.
Well, and we know that austerity doesn't work. You know, that in economics, anybody who had a good economics professor was taught, even if you just took one or two courses, something called accounting identities. They may not have called them that. But on a worldwide basis, spending equals income. Okay? That's one of these accounting identities. It's a mathematical, an algebraic equation that must be true. Well, if spending goes down, incomes have to go down. So if private spending goes down, then government spending needs to go up to make up for it. Otherwise, you're in a vicious downward cycle, which is what we're doing. And fundamentally, Americans have been sold on this idea that the government's budget is like a household budget. No, it's not at all. It's an entirely different kind of
animal. I try to make that argument to people, but they don't. Would you make that clear about why that's true?
Well, first of all, here is a statement that is absolutely true. No government with monopoly control of its currency, that's our Constitution, no government with monopoly control of its currency can ever go broke in its own currency. Now, I'm sure there are people listening right now who are saying, oh, well, I've got some Russian rubles from the 1900s. I'm sorry, the government of the czars is gone. I said no government. So unless the U.S. government topples, and, you know, there is a new survey by Fairleigh Dickinson showing that 44% of Republicans believe what this country needs is an armed revolution. Fox News has a poll they do year after year which shows that about 44% of people believe that there are angels following them around and around 25% believe there are witches. So don't be surprised why we have people like Michelle Bachmann and Mike Huckabee on the national scene. The fundamental issue here is that the government is in a unique position. The reason Greece is in trouble is it doesn't have its own currency. If the Greeks went back to the drachma, and if they also had a tax system that actually collected taxes, they would simply adjust their currency rates for trading with other countries, and they would work their way out of the problem. It's that they have the euro that's at the core of the problem, which, by the way, a lot of economists predicted before the Treaty of Maastricht that led to the euro. The U.S. government, as we've seen, has through the Federal Reserve, which is the outsourced central bank, has infused the economy with capital. There's no inflation. We're actually in a deflation. Wages are falling. The only people raising prices are the monopolists, the ones who have market power. One of the things people need to understand about this is that the big multinational corporations, there's 2,600 of them, and they own over 80% of the business assets in America. Now, think about that. There are 6 million corporations in America, but 80% of the assets are owned by 2,600 of them. They've actually figured out how to turn taxes into a profit center. And let me use Apple to show how this works. Apple has $36 billion of untaxed profits offshore, technically. They actually have that money on deposit in New York in banks. They open an account at, say, J.P. Morgan, a too-big-to-fail bank, and say, go buy U.S. government debt. So we're not collecting the $36 billion in taxes that they owe, okay? If they hold on to that money and reinvest it and earn 3% compounded, 30 years from now, they'll have $87 billion. Now they can pay the $36 billion, which is not adjusted for inflation. It'll be worth less than half, well less than half that. And they'll have $51 billion left. Now, that's from their perspective. So they're making money off taxes. They delay paying for 30 years. They get $50 billion to put in their pocket, and they pay their tax bill. During those 30 years, you and I and the rest of the taxpayers borrowed $36 billion. From whom? Apple. Mm-hmm. We paid that $51 billion of interest to Apple. Then we collect the equivalent of $15 million back. But even that game, we're losing money. We're losing $15 billion over the years, the difference between the nominal value of the tax and the amount of interest we're paying. People have no idea. Now, you have to pay your taxes if you're a worker or a pensioner before you get your money. The government does not trust you. Congress does not trust you. But if you are a hedge fund manager or a private equity manager like Mitt Romney, you can defer 100% of your money back into your hedge fund or your private equity deal and pay no taxes. How are you going to live? Well, most of these people have a salary and other investments, but as a practical matter, what you do is, you know, hey, I've got a $5 billion fortune here, and you go to Goldman Sachs and say, well, I need $20 million to live on this year. They loan you $20 million. At the end of the year, you owe $400,000 interest. And you say, well, so roll that over into a new loan and give me another $20 million. Meanwhile, your $5 billion fortune has become $5.5 billion. Mm-hmm. And you are getting richer and richer and richer. And so long as your consumption is less than your fortune, in fact, less than the growth of your fortune, you will never have to pay taxes, except when, you know, you need to sell an investment because it's become a bad investment or a company is cashed out and you're forced. But that's just incidental income. You know, that's like you get some check in the mail unexpectedly for something you didn't know about for $10. To these guys, it's, you know, $50 million.
You know, so while all this is going on, I was on The Daily Show this week. John Oliver was calling this the summer of scandal. This whole IRS to-do seems like a smokescreen to me.
Well, there are a couple of actual scandals here. First of all, let's be clear that it is inappropriate to select any group for review based on its name. That is no different than the New York police stopping young men on the streets of New York because of the color of their skin and frisking them. That said, what did the inspector general in his report say? The inspector general, a former political operative on the staff of Bob Dole and other Republican politicians and appointee of George W. Bush, he found that of the 96 groups with Tea Party, Glenn Beck, 912 in their names, all but 17 needed to be scrutinized, that they should have been. So the only issue is we picked you for the wrong reason. And then, you know, what do the cops say when they do that? Well, yeah, maybe you think we shouldn't stop them, but we just took a gun off this kid, which rarely happens, by the way.
Right.
The IRS, however, wow, they had a more than 80% pick the right person for analysis. And that's not unlike IRS audits. Two-thirds of people who are audited pay more taxes. And of the remaining third, half are found to have paid their taxes properly, and half are found that they're due money. And the IRS says, oh, you paid too much. We're going to send you a check. Well, that's what happened here. These groups, in their applications, put a target on themselves. As if, you know, somebody walks into a store and there's a Volkswagen ad on TV that's a joke about it. You walk into a store with a ski mask on. We all assume you're a bad guy who's going to rob the place. In their applications, they said things like, we want to elect people to office.
Which is not what those particular groups are supposed to do.
501c4, which has been around since 1913, it began as part of a treaty and was requested by the Chamber of Commerce, is, and I'll quote the statute, exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. In 1959, during the Eisenhower administration, the IRS put an implementing regulation in that said, exclusively means primarily for the promotion of social welfare. Now, why did they do this? Well, there were groups that wanted to be assured that if, let's say, they're promoting bike lanes, you have let's have more bike lanes in, and of which there are many groups, right down to let's have naked bike rides here in Portland.
Well, yes.
Yes.
Well, and social, for the social good could be interpreted many ways also.
Well, but the IRS clearly says in its regulations it's not politics. But they wanted to know they could go to the city council or the state legislature and say, we want to have more money spent on bike lanes. It wasn't for partisan politics. And over time, this has morphed into, the extreme example, primarily, after all, by the most generous definition, means 50% plus one, right? Well, if you look at the tax return of Carl Rove's Crossroads GPS for, I think it's 2011 or 2012, literally 99.9% is political activity, ostensibly having nothing to do with the Republican Party or trying to beat the Democratic candidate. And there is one item that's equal to 0.1% that says right on it, social welfare. Now, another scandal here is all of these Tea Party groups going around saying they wanted to know our donors. If you contribute to a nonprofit any significant amount of money, I forget what the threshold is, I think it's $250 or more, the IRS gets your name. The public doesn't get your name. But you file something called Schedule B, and as an officer of nonprofits, I've had to sign a number of these. I'm the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, for example. I have to sign and I approve our tax return. So the government gets these anyway. This is an absurdity. This is people who don't know how government works. Surprise, surprise. There are people in the Tea Party I've interviewed who don't understand that Medicare is a government program. They think it's a Blue Cross program, and somehow this generous company just provides them medical care out of the goodness of its heart. But the real scandal here is that the IRS has been shrunk 17% in real terms since 2002. The tax code has been made enormously more complex, not for anything that deals with you, me, or anybody listening to this show, but favors that congressmen sell to campaign donors, and lobbyists get put in when they go in and say, well, we just need this little rule adjusted to be fair. We just want a level playing field. And what they're really doing, of course, is tilting the field. Mm-hmm. And so that's the real scandal. And this continual assertion by the far right that I've read newspaper accounts quoting the Portage County, Ohio Tea Party leader. Well, we all know what was happening here. President Obama was doing opposition research. Yeah, you know, the president of the United States, he has so little duty to do. He is looking into the tax return of the Tea Party in rural Portage, Ohio, to gather information for his campaign because, you know, he won't get reelected if the Portage County Tea Party is there. And by the way, to be clear, I'm a very big critic of President Obama. I was the first national journalist to really tear into him 9 days after he took office over something that turned out to be a real problem. And that is lack of transparency and the not answering questions from the press if they don't like him.
Right.
But, you know, the idea that the president is sitting there going, oh, we're going to get these tax returns, it's absurd. And there's not one shred of evidence in support of that. And by the way, the guy who said we need to review the Tea Party groups, he was interviewed under oath. I'm not sure it was under oath, it was with the transcript. He says, I'm a conservative Republican. It's a conservative Republican who said, we need to look at these groups.
Right. Well, I want to remind people that you are, in fact, listening to KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn. And we are here with David K. Johnston. We have about half an hour, and we've got people on the phone who would really like to talk with you.
And if you yourself are interested in calling in with a question or comment, the phone number is 503-231-8187. Also, of course, you can follow along on Facebook. You can find us positivelyrevolting.com. I'm sorry, facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. The other way around. You can also email us, of course, at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Johnston.
David, please.
I'm sorry. Good morning, David. Hey, I've been watching these Bill Moyers specials on PBS for over 20 years now, and I know you've been a guest on his show, and, you know, there have been wonderful guests like Bartlett and Steele and Barbara Ehrenreich and so on and so forth, but it seems like there's just kind of an itemizing of the horrors of what's going on, and what interests me the most is trying to figure out how poor and working-class Americans are going to regain some leverage it seems like it's not only regulatory capture, but political capture. Our society is now a place where cheaters prosper. And I was wondering, you know, we have the Reagan Revolution. We had the Powell Memo, where the right-wing think tanks were established to basically roll back the New Deal. But I was wondering what your thought would be in terms of how in Western Europe, you know, they have a history of a far left.
Right.
You know, the legacy here of the blacklist, of the McCarthy era, the Red Scare and all that, we don't have an organized far left, you know, as a form of leverage against right. the power of capital. So I self-identify as a Marxist, not because I think it's cool, but because I think, you know, how else are we going to regain leverage, you know, against the power of Wall Street and the capitalist class?
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Sean, first of all, I think if you self-identify to most people as a Marxist, you're going to turn them off. I mean, there's a crowd of people you really get, but unfortunately, we've totally demonized Marx, even though even at conservative schools of economics, they teach Marx because he had great insights. And don't miss the fact that Bill Moyers has been marginalized by PBS and moved to a time when it's not convenient to watch him. And if you get the chance, tell him, please have me back on. in Europe, you had this tradition of guilds, and it predated the Industrial Revolution. And it's the reason that you have a long, well-developed cultural history of working people, artisans in particular, who developed a culture that understood the need of those groups to have power to deal with not just the capitalist class, but the government as well. And in this country, what was one of the first things that was set out to be done? It was to reduce unions. When 37% of private sector employees were union members in 1973, that is the peak year of income for the bottom 90% of Americans. If you worked for General Motors and you were a third-level supervisor, guess what? Your pay was set by the UAW. You didn't have any bargaining power. When I was at the New York Times, an editor, not a section editor, not a deputy editor, but an editor with significant authority in directing reporters, came to me one day and said, so how are you guys doing at the union? And I said, I'm not involved here. I'd been head of the union in Philadelphia. And I said, I'm not involved in the contract talks. He says, oh. And I said, why? I said, you're in management. He says, yeah, but come on, the union sets my pay. And we've lost sight of that. And as soon as, of course, we got rid of unions, we began to have wages trending downwards. I have a column at National Memo that went up last week with two killer graphics from the federal government. Labor share. There's a return to the economy. Labor gets part of it. Capital gets part of it. Labor's share is just falling off the right end of the chart. Then there's corporate profits, which is not exactly the same measure, but it gives you the same result, and you see them skyrocketing. Now, what do we do about that? Well, I think people need to organize. They need to confront their legislators. I would recommend you get a group of people, you come up with, for a particular lawmaker, some killer questions, and you can go across the border to Washington if you live in Oregon, but come up with some very cogent killer questions. And when there is a public meeting, everybody go and separately and sit in different parts of the room and ask your question. Don't make a speech, just ask your question. And when the politician tries to slither off it, somebody should get up and say, wait a minute, we want to hear an answer to that question. And somebody else, if they slither away, say, well, hold on, this is important. I want to hear that. I don't want you to go away. And if suddenly people in a room of 100 realize 5 or 6 people are doing this, you can turn the room very quickly. And if you keep doing this, politicians will begin to get the message that the public is not going to put up with this. Instead, the incentives they have right now are to do things contrary to your interests.
Yeah, but what do the politicians do that are spending so much time having to make money to be reelected? I mean, I know they may see that the public
right.
doesn't like it, but
they've got to raise money. And, right. and the answer to that is that in two states, Arizona and Maine, we've tried public finance of elections. And the great fear of that, of course, is the incumbents will get reelected. Gee, that would be a change, wouldn't it? Well, lo and behold, voters turned the incumbents out. If you weren't performing, they started turning you out. One of the things to do, I think, is to promote a law that says that no one may contribute to a candidate for office unless they live in the jurisdiction.
And
I believe, now I'm not a lawyer, but I do know enough about the law that I'm a professor at a law school. that I believe that would withstand constitutional muster. And even if it didn't, the debate over it would be really good for the country. You can give – you want to give unlimited amounts, fine, as long as it's disclosed. It would be fine given our current situation. Okay. But only if you live in the jurisdiction. You live in the state of Oregon or you live in the district of a member of Congress.
We have Brian on the line. We have a dozen questions lined up for you. We have 25 minutes.
All right, we'll go quick and short. I apologize.
No.
You, we have you here to talk.
Apologize so. Not. Brian, good morning. You're on
good
the air.
Good morning. Yeah, let's digress. No, I'm just kidding. Listen, I want to ask you, I have a question and a statement. You know, I've waited for somebody to comment on the $35 tax that all Portlanders have to pay for schools, which is great. I mean, you know,
it was arts. Broke, I believe right? It's an arts tax.
Yeah, it's an arts tax, and I think it's great. I mean, I don't have kids, but I'm right behind it. But I didn't pay it because Target's moving in, and I'm sure they got huge tax breaks. Nike,
no,
you know, and that's money that's not going to our schools. So,
right.
Like $35 at $10 an hour. You know, I work about 90 hours a month now, you know. So, I mean, like, it's just not feasible for me, you know, and that was my first. I'd like to hear a comment on that. And the second comment is a little tad esoteric, okay? But I don't, I would really like to hear some, you know, thinkers like yourself describe, you know, corporatization, monopolistic control, leading to fascism. And where does, and you know, every time I look back, fascism always leads to social, you know, it leads to genocide.
Okay, gotcha.
And I'd like to hear some comments.
Well, Brian, I don't know about the specifics of your art tax. I mean, without a question, here's Phil Knight, certainly one of the wealthiest people in Oregon by far. And, you know, he embodies what the Republicans have identified as our major social problem. Democrats can't figure out what to do, but the Republicans have identified the major economic problem America has, and they have a solution, and I want to give them credit for it. And they've said, almost in the words I'm going to use, what the problem is. When they tell you the job creators need lower taxes, they won't create jobs. By the way, I'm a job creator, 25 jobs. what they're saying is the rich don't have nearly enough, that's our economic problem. The rich don't have enough to create jobs, and they have a solution to get them that money, which is embedded in the cutting taxes. They're going to take from the poor, the disabled, the elderly, the sick, and children to give to the rich. That's exactly what they're doing, and we should stop pussyfooting around about it and say you're simply socialists who want to redistribute upward. You're the pigs in Orwell's farm who need the milk and apples because, you know, it's not really for our benefit. It's for yours because we're doing the work here of creating the jobs. I think people like Phil Knight, who I've never met, but who do these deals, ought to be publicly vilified and shamed. They ought to be shamed. Now, on the other issue about corporatization, you know, go to the library and check out my book, The Fine Print. It will explain all of this stuff to you. It opens very early on, I tell a science fiction story to help people understand what's going on about corporations and what they're doing to America. And corporations are important to have. But when corporations, the proto-corporations, began in the ancient world, they were created to serve the state. Emperor Lin appoints a General Ani here to go suppress the Gauls. Well, somebody has to manage the property. I get named the property manager, and these were the proto-corporations. Corporations encourage you to take risk. We don't want to go back to Hammurabi's code where if you took a risk to borrow money and couldn't pay it back, you and your children and your concubines and could all be sold into slavery, although only for 3 years. And not the slavery of the Old South, the slavery of the ancient world. Basically, this was a bankruptcy law. You could lend money and collect the labor of 3 years, and it limited how much was loaned. We want to encourage people to take risk. What we don't want to do is make the state exist in service to the corporation. We've got this backwards. And nothing will drive us into poverty overall, and maybe that revolution some of the 44% of the Republicans want faster than not recognizing that. But please go read, it's a trilogy of books I wrote, The Perfectly Legal, which is on taxes, and KBOO's been very good to have me on for each of these books, Free Lunch, which is a lot about Oregon, which is about subsidies, and now The Fine Print, which is about monopolies, restraint of trade, taking away consumer rights.
You know, before we move on to our next caller, I just want to, you had mentioned earlier, you gave the great illustrative example of Apple and how they don't pay taxes and how that can
They pay taxes. Well, there's nowhere near what they should be paying.
Yeah, okay, good. I ran across a statistic a couple months ago. And it was an estimate by the Tax Justice Network suggesting that deposits in offshore banking are up to about $21
trillion dollars.
Yeah. So when you suck $21 trillion out of the global economy,
you're not taking it out of the economy. That's the important element.
Okay.
These people are using that money. They're not being taxed on it. This is $21 trillion of untaxed profits. A lot of it.
So they're
hidden.
Taking it unto themselves.
They're taking it unto themselves, and they're not participating in the economy in the same way that if you're a billionaire, you borrow against your assets and don't pay taxes. And this is the problem where the very wealthy and the politicians and the economists who see the world through their eyes have figured out that the thing to do is narrow the base at the top, design rules that don't apply to these people in terms of taxes or don't fund law enforcement to hunt for these people. And then you can make the working people pay the taxes. You know, Leona Helmsley was quite right when she said only little people pay taxes. I mean, Warren Buffett paid a lot of money in taxes the year that he disclosed it. If I recall correctly, it was $11 million. Compared to his fortune, it was all because of what I call incidental income. He had some investments that got cashed out, whether he liked it or not, or he got some dividends he couldn't avoid. His company doesn't pay dividends. So he had to pay this little bit of tax. And at least Warren Buffett, who I'm very critical of in my books, at least Warren Buffett recognizes and acknowledges that the system doesn't operate the way it should.
It reminds me very much of an old quote by Michael Parenti, who said, you know, when it comes to benefiting the elite, don't worry, your money is no object.
That's very good.
So let's go ahead and talk to Harvey. Good morning, Harvey. You're on the line.
Hi, Lynn, and hi, Annie. Great show today. And hello, David.
Hi.
Well, I feel that we were sort of behind the eight ball when our factories were shipped out and our jobs to the lowest common wage. And then we were behind the eight ball when they set up prisons for profit in America, our answer to third world labor. And I feel that it's time to get in front of the eight ball because of the coming revolution. And the revolution is going to be robots, 3D printers, and artificial intelligence. And those three are coming up real fast. And basically, I'm calling for a national guaranteed income to compensate us to share the wealth because, number one, it'll all be placed in the hands of a few and we'll all be essentially working for them. But, you know, it's not, you know, in the past we've always said, well, people are lazy, you know, they gotta, you know, we all have the dream of becoming rich and famous and all that. But the thing is that we're not set up to be put upon by robots. Robots, you know, one robot can replace seven people. They don't need health care. They don't want retirement benefits. And, you know, that's who they'll hire. They'll hire robots instead of people.
So is there a question in there, Harvey?
Yes, the question is, President Eisenhower and President Nixon were both for national guaranteed income. How do you feel about a national guaranteed income with the coming revolution and robots, 3D printers?
Okay.
Thank you, Harvey.
Harvey, this is actually something that I'm very, very deeply worried about. I think the biggest single problem we face in the world is the technologies that are so wonderful have a downside to them. And we need a new paradigm in economics. You are exactly right that what's happening, I would not define it the way you did. I would define the problem as more and more labor is performed by capital. So imagine you lived in the ancient world. You had a job. You carried a sack of wheat from here to there. If you saved your money, you could eventually buy a donkey. Now you can carry a lot more wheat. You can save that money and buy a cart. And if you keep saving your money, pretty soon you'll have two carts. Mm-hmm. And today you can have a truck and ultimately, I guess, a one-person short line railroad. Mm-hmm. More and more labor is performed by capital, and the number of jobs that are needed will radically shrink. In fact, if these American companies, the 52,000 factories that were shut here and the production was moved to China, came back to the U.S., there would actually be fewer jobs in the world because Chinese factories are remarkably inefficient, but labor is so cheap nobody cares. Well, if 0.1% of the population owns about 25% of the financial capital and 1% owns more than half the financial capital, what happens in a world where what's going to happen in industrial America is what happened in agricultural America. In 1800, 90% of people were tied to the farm. In 1900, more than a third were tied to the farm. In 2000, it was around 1%. What are we going to do? Now, the ancient Egyptians had a solution. They built all these monuments. They paid people. They kept them busy because idle hands are the devil's workshop. And you want trouble, have people with no work. Go see what's going on in Turkey where—
Have you seen Timberline Lodge?
No.
That was a 30s thing.
Public works
that
project.
That was a public works project. We have a few of those around.
Oh, sure. Sure.
And we have, so that happened.
We have schools and police departments and other buildings around the country that were built and we're still able to use because we built really significant, mm-hmm. solid buildings. So we need to have a policy that begins to examine that. And it's not that there isn't work we could be doing, an overwhelming amount of work we could be doing, but we need to have a fundamental discussion about our economics and we need to recognize where we're going. And you're quite right. A guaranteed income by itself is not going to solve the problem. We have to change the way we think about economics. And, you know, if there's anything in the world I wish, it isn't that I could have $1 billion. It's that my brain at this age, I'm 64, would be able to figure out a new economic theory the same way Adam Smith changed the world when he recognized markets, that Vilfredo Pareto did when he recognized distribution, that John Maynard Keynes did when he recognized the need to balance between government and private spending and investment.
Excellent.
Yeah,
that's
well,
a fine goal.
I don't think I'm going to make it.
Well, we all wish you luck.
Yeah.
It is about 8:46. We are speaking with David K. Johnston here in KBOO Studio. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn. This is Positively Revolting. And I want to remind folks that David K. Johnston is speaking in town tonight at the First Unitarian Church. That's at 12th and Salmon. And in Elliott Chapel. He'll be speaking on the rise of the monopolists, why the few get rich while your paycheck shrinks. This is sponsored by KBOO, also by the Alliance for Democracy. And, you know, it's at 7 o'clock tonight.
They have a policy, unless I'm wrong, that, well, there's a fee they want to collect to cover the costs of doing this. I'm not getting paid for it. That nobody's going to be turned away if they don't have the money to be able to attend.
That is wonderful. We have a caller on the line. I want to make sure that we can get you in there as well. And good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ani. I have a couple of points to make about the cultural change. May Day, for instance, is considered anathema here, and yet that holiday was initially to celebrate and to memorialize the workers from the strike in Chicago in the 1880s, where they had the Haymarket martyrs. And that's completely unknown. It's considered, oh, that's completely communist, Marxist, whatever. But no, it was internationally done to honor American workers and the American labor movement. We had a number of significant socialists here that were interesting, though. We had Carl Sandburg. We had Helen Keller. We had Jack London. We had a remarkable number of people who were self-identified socialists and activists, and yet they were not affiliated with necessarily with Marxism at all. Norman Thomas was, I think, a Methodist minister. But anyway, this cultural change. I'm a union man, and I was a member of a weak union, and for 6 years I tried to bring up the issue that we were considered like lawn workers, garden, you know, lawn care maintenance people, rather than professional tree trimmers. You know.
So, is there a question in there?
I was just gonna go there.
Oh, the question in there is, you have such a backward thing in this country culturally that our complete history, and the unions didn't even teach union history or what unions were about to the workers, so that even men benefiting from the union despised it. and not even recognizing that they were at least getting better benefits.
So is there a question in there, Steve?
Yes. How do you overcome this studied ignorance?
Okay. Look, we have an education system that's a good question. Mm-hmm. We have an education system that was designed to create docile drones. I mean, think about just the way we organize our schools. You will sit in a desk in a grid format, and you will be polite, and you won't, you know, reach over and pull the girl's hair next to you if you're a little boy, or draw silly-faced pictures and show them to your friends. That's just designed to produce drones. We do not teach critical thinking. The first of many, many trips that I took to the principal's office in school was in sixth grade in Santa Cruz, California, where my very, very nice teacher, terrific woman teacher, was teaching the approved lesson about the missions. And I raised my hand and I said, well, what about how the priests would torture and murder the Indians who wouldn't bow down and confess their Savior Jesus Christ? And I wouldn't budge from this. And I was sent to the office, not for saying something that wasn't true, but for upsetting my other children.
Mm-hmm.
I think that unions have forgotten a fundamental principle, and to some extent they may not have done it very well, and that is you have to organize constantly. Mm-hmm. I was the head of the Newspaper Guild in Philadelphia, and when we went to take our strike vote, which every union does before a contract, we were losing the room. And it was real clear. People were getting up with the kind Steve describes, describing the union as being their problem. And I went up to the podium and I said, can I have the floor for a moment? And everybody calmed down for a moment and I said, you have the best pension plan in all newspapers in America. You think the company gave that to you out of the goodness of your heart? Your union got that for you. You have a health care plan with virtually no copays like everybody else around you. You think the company gave that to you because they're such nice people? The union did that for you. And I went through this long list, and I got a rousing unanimous strike vote. By reminding people of that. I went and spoke at a UAW hall about 5 years ago when Free Lunch came out and got the same thing from a bunch of UAW guys. And I did the same thing and turned the room around. This is a function of union leaders need to be out saying, the company doesn't want to give you a health care plan. They want to take it away from you. And by the way, in my books, I explain the reason companies are doing this. It's a hidden form of addition to executive pay that I explain and I show in two of the three books, Perfectly Legal and the current book, The Fine Print, how funding this extra benefit for executives forces them to remove health care and pension plans for workers and how the economics of that work. But that's what we absolutely need to do. We need to have union leaders who get out and they say, we're entitled to negotiate. By the way, if you don't believe in unions, I say you don't believe in market economics. Here's a company, or the city government of Portland, or the state of Wisconsin, and here's a freshly minted 18-year-old high school grad or a 23-year-old school teacher. They know nothing. Who's on the other side? A sophisticated operation with studies, consultants, human relations, lawyers who know exactly the value of your labor, and their job is to get you to work for less than that. If you have a union, you have some balance of power. Unions represent market economics. Every Republican in America who believes in market economics should be instructed that if you don't believe in unions, you don't believe in market economics.
I want to just look at a little social aspect to all of this. And it's part of the sort of the veil that comes down that goes right along with the fact that we are raised not to be critical thinkers, that we are raised to parrot the lines of mainstream media and sort of not expand the discourse, but to parrot the discourse. And that is the poor are subjected to all manner of indignities to collect their meager state support. Mandatory drug testing comes to mind. Corporations, on the other hand, are given billions.
Corporations in this country were allowed to destroy the economy through fraud and no prosecutions. No prosecutions on Wall Street, not one. If you get to be 100% disabled. I have a brother who lives here in Oregon who was a manual laborer. You got to work because he was out there cleaning the culvert in the snowstorm, and he can't even stand up straight. His disability from the federal government is, I think, $780 a month, out of which comes $100 plus for Medicare. You're supposed to live on
that's
this?
That's high living, I tell you.
Yeah, yeah. And David Vitter, you remember David Vitter, Mr. Family mm-hmm. Values mm-hmm. from Louisiana. David Vitter has sponsored a piece of legislation which anyone ever convicted of a felony may never get, nor can their family, which means children that may not be born yet, food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, this same standard of felons not collecting would not, under Mr. Vitter's bill, apply to farmers who get benefits from the government. We are seeing the entire mechanism of the government being used to benefit the rich at the expense of other people. And, you know, it will change when we vote out of office the people who are doing this.
How do we pierce through that mindset, though? How do we pierce the person who has class anger at people who are maybe a half a step under the level that they are at, but ignore the billions given to the elite?
Here I would fault the churches and the synagogues and the mosques whose leaders need to be out talking to their flocks about this. And I would fault the newspapers and the editorial pages about this. And I would encourage a movement to stop the mean. You know, being mean to people. You know, one of the things in this wonderful documentary, American Winter, about these eight families in Portland is they can't find jobs. Well, somebody in the audience, sure enough, last night in Salem got up and basically said, you know, well, why don't they have jobs? The population since 2000 has been growing 10 times faster than the number of jobs. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? It means there's 9 people looking for a job who aren't going to get one. And some of these people have college degrees, and they finally got jobs at minimum wage or barely over minimum wage because the policy of the government of the United States is to drive down wages and reduce jobs. And we are the people. We can change this. We got rid of slavery. Women got back the right to vote, which they had in some of the colonies. It took 72 years. We got child labor laws. It took half as long. We got pretty good environmental laws signed by a Republican president, although if he came back to life today, I think that the Republicans would put him somewhere near Dennis Kucinich as a toxic lefty.
True.
So,
well, more? Well, we are so close to being out of time.
We're almost out of show here.
I just want to maybe ask, so people that are concerned, because anyone that's listening right now, by God, you know, we'd best be concerned. How do we participate? How do we help to turn it over?
Well, first of all, I'm in the diagnosis business, not the solutions business, all right? But the very first thing I would encourage you to do is go read my books, okay? There's 3 of them. It's a trilogy. I have a new book coming out, an anthology in the fall that's about inequality with contributions by people like Joe Stiglitz and Senator Elizabeth Warren and others. But first, educate yourself about these things. And you know, take notes and study. Sit down. You don't have to, you know, I'm never going to make another dollar off my books. I'm not shilling here to make more money off the books. I've been paid for them. But go read them. They are full of stuff you haven't seen anywhere else. And start telling people about this. Secondly, do some simple things. Write cogent, very concise letters to the local newspaper. Get on radio shows. Call the managers of, you know, there's a little sign I'm looking at here that says, hey, people, be careful about the language you use because the FCC is not happy with us. You know, here you got a bunch of radio stations in Portland that are purely commercial animals. They do the absolute minimum public service for their use of the public airwaves. Go complain about their FCC licenses. Go to the Oregon Public Utilities Commission and get people to sign petitions and demand that they hold public hearings in downtown Portland or if they're going to do – or somewhere near Portland if they're going to do a PacifiCorp rate case or a PGE rate case. Organize. Act. Don't sit around and say, I can't do anything. You've got the numbers. You just have to work at it.
Thank you so much.
And that is
our guest this morning has been David K. Johnston. He is going to be speaking tonight about the rise of monopolists, why the few get rich while your paycheck shrinks. A very good subject at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon at 7 o'clock. And no one will be turned away. And, you know, if you've enjoyed him this morning, you will really enjoy him when he gets going this evening.
And you can find archives for this program on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/positivelyrevolting. You can also, of course, find us on Facebook, follow a conversation throughout the week, stay in touch, facebook.com/positivelyrevolting, or stay in touch with us through email at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. With that, we are out of time. David, thank you so very much for joining us.
Ani and Lynn, thank you.
You're welcome.
Absolutely a pleasure. Stay tuned for the incomparable Radio Zine here on KBOO, your community radio station.
second every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Voices of the Middle East, host Gudarz Ekhtar, excuse me,